you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. Joining me once again is our fellow network all-star, Chris Franklin. Hello, Chris.
We must preserve the myth, Rob.
Who are you impersonating?
I was trying to do Brando.
Oh, all right. Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, we'll get into that quote because there's no way Marlon Brando said that. But okay. Yeah. For those of you that have already looked at the show notes, this is we're here to talk about all new collector's edition number C62, Superman the Movie. And much like this particular Treasury edition, this episode of Treasury Cast is a naked commercial announcement, because we're here to talk about and promote our upcoming show, Superman Movie Minute, which Chris and I, are co-hosting, which debuts its first of many weekly episodes on Monday, September 25th. So we thought it would be a perfect time to talk about this really interesting Treasury book, and it would be a nice tie-in to our upcoming show. I'm very excited. We've been working on this show for months and months and months, so I'm very excited that we're finally here and ready to start having people listen to the episode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm ready to go.
All right. It's good. I can hear you rubbing your hands. Yeah. This is, as I said, this is all new collector's edition number C62. It was formerly known as Limited Collector's Edition, and then as DC started putting all new, as you might realize, material into their books, they changed it from limited over to all new, but they kept the numbering the same. That's how you know it's an old-timey comic, when there's a title change and they didn't start over at number one. So this book was on sale December 14th, 1978, a mere 4 days before the movie debuted. And for any of you who have not read this comic or familiar with it, this is not an adaptation of the movie. So, Chris, why don't you explain to everybody why this is not? Well, you would think if there's any character they could adapt their movie, it would be Superman. Why isn't this an adaptation of the movie?
Two words, Mario Puzo.
All right, we're going to need a little more information than that.
I believe that it was in his contract that he signed with the Salkinds that if they were to make an adaptation of his work, he got paid like gajillions of dollars, basically what it amounts to. And then I've also heard that he just flat out said you can't. It's according to which version you subscribe to. But either way, he's the reason why there was no comic adaptation or no novelization of Superman the movie.
How insane is that? That DC could not do a comic book adaptation of Superman the movie. That is the
right.
Like, you just look at that on paper, you're like, that makes no sense. That is, especially when you think about when we all know that this movie was essentially really written by Tom Mankiewicz, not Mario Puzo.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's like the Salkinds signed this horrible contract with him, and then they didn't even really use his script as was, obviously. So it's a lose-lose for everybody, really.
Yeah. Yeah, they got him because he was Mario Puzo. You know, he was the biggest right. name out there. Very few screenwriters were ever famous. This always baffled me as a kid. I didn't have this book, but I did remember, wanting to find a Superman comic book that was the movie, and there was no such book. And, as a 7-year-old, I'm like, what? You're like, why did – and then I was – this is during the age of newsstand distribution. I always assumed that I just couldn't find it, that it must exist. Right. But no, it does not exist. So DC was really stuck with what to do. So instead of doing an adaptation, they did essentially a big movie magazine. It's like the kind of stuff that Famous Monsters used to do, all the Warren magazines where they would do special editions of movies. So this is a big behind-the-scenes feature about the movie. We'll get into all the various things inside. But first, the cover. The cover, of course, has the great Superman movie logo where it looks like it's made out of crystal. It's got a wonderful shot of Superman, of Christopher Reeve, wearing the wrong kind of boots. And it says, a collector's album of the most spectacular movie ever made. Stars, costumes, set design, special effects. And then we see little shots of the movie Superman pretending to be a piece of train track. Jor-El, Gene Hackman as Luthor, and little baby Cal lifting up the truck. So what is with those boots? What happened there? I don't understand.
I don't know. I mean, I guess they're probably just – I mean, that's from that famous photo shoot, the same one where he's pointing upwards, which I don't know if you knew this. I'm sure you did. But those poses were actually conceptualized by Nick Carty.
I did not know that.
Yes, Nick Carty. It's in one of the Nick Carty art books I have, I think, that Tomorrow's published. And he actually come up with some concepts for a photo shoot for Superman the movie, and including the pointing up pose, which this is very similar to, but his arms are down to his side. Nick Carty probably, I mean, that's just Superman standing there, but the lighting and everything, he probably conceptualized this photo too. So
that's really cool. I never heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so, good on you, Nick Carty.
Right. So Nick Carty was still doing DC covers even late into the 70s in a weird sort of way.
Oh, that's awesome. I love it. I love that Nick Carty got a little bit of movie money. That's fantastic. Good for him. All right. So on the inside cover, there's some film strips, and we see a bunch of shots. There's another Superman pose, which now you've just told me must be a Nick Carty conceptualized drawing of him down at the bottom there and standing in front of Metropolis. And we see Valerie Perrine pretending to be unconscious. Superman carrying, it looks like he's moving. What is Superman flying and carrying? I can't. Is he just moving that big piece of rock? Is that before he stops up the dam? Is that what that is? I think it is.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Yeah.
And we see the destruction of Krypton. We see the Phantom Zone villains. All a bunch of cool stuff. So, and then the Caped Wonder stuns city thing. Actually, that photo must be behind the scenes because in the left hand side is Richard Donner holding the prop Daily Planet, and everybody's sort of looking on at him. So this must be a behind the scenes thing. So, and then
hold on yep, just a second. Oh, you're on the inside back cover, right?
No, I'm on the inside front cover.
That is so weird. All these images you're talking about?
Yeah.
They're on my inside back cover.
What?
Yes.
That's weird.
Because I've got on the inside back cover, I've got Jor-El and the Phantom Zone villains. I've got Trevor Howard looking up with the Krypton destruction.
Right.
Donner holding the Cape Wonderstone City. And then on my inside front cover, I got Ma and Pa Kent, Superman, Jackie Cooper holding Cape Wonderstone City, Margot Kidder, Lois and Clark in the alley when he catches the bullet. Did they flip them?
I wonder if this was flipped because, yeah, mine has all that, but it's the inside back cover. And it's got the credits, right?
Yeah, it's got the credits, but it's on – and it's got this – awesome picture of Valerie Perrine above the Superman logo.
Yeah. Wow, look at that. That's weird.
Yeah, so they flipped. So either I've got a rare edition or something where they goofed up. Or
I've got one, yeah. Or
you've got one, yeah.
Somebody must have bumped the machine or something like that. That's weird. That's funny. Huh.
Yeah, and it's especially since it's a spread, you know. I mean, it's obviously it's a two-sided print. It's, you know, print on the other side of the cover. I mean, the front cover muck is Superman in front of the flag. It's the title of the book and everything, yeah. You know. Huh. So, weird.
That is very strange. All right. Well, one of us has an incredibly valuable book, Chris. I don't know if we'll know about it. So, all right. Very cool. So, well, anyway, we've got the table of contents, and it gives a bunch of quotes, all the various actors. It talks about the contributors, and it lists a bunch of DC staffers. If you look there, you can closely you see Murphy Anderson, Mike W. Barr, Ross Andrew, Wayne Boring, E. Nelson Bridwell, Continuity Associates. It does not mention Nick Carty anywhere, but I guess he wasn't involved in this book specifically. Barbara Zakas, Kurt Schaffenberger, Adrian Roy, basic Kurt Swan, Jerry Siegel, Joe Shuster, basically everybody you'd be familiar with working at the at DC. And it opens up, the first article is Krypton, the homeworld of Superman. And then there's a big shot of Jor-El holding the baby. We see the Lara with the kid and kind of cooing to the baby. This must be a off the, you know, like not a movie scene where she's smiling down at the baby, obviously. And then this is the first indication of something I really like is at the bottom of that page. It shows you a sequence from the comics talking about this very scene of them putting the baby mm-hmm. in a rocket. And I love that throughout this book, they will be constantly contrasting the movie version with the comic version.
Right. Yeah, that's I like it. It's a Wayne Boring version. It's Jor-El in his short sleeve shirt with his cape. He looks like a Green Robin kind of.
Yeah, that's his superhero costume there.
Right. Yeah, it's sharp. Yeah. Real quick before, I don't know if you might want to edit this out or go back. Did you notice who did the front cover design of the book?
No. Who did the front? Who did the front cover? Did front cover design? Neil Posner.
Yes.
Look at that. The guy that wrote the Aquaman miniseries. I had no idea he was at DC this far back.
Me neither.
Look at that. Wow. Nice catch, Chris. Yeah, I had.
So Neil Posner, and so Neil Posner designed a cover that had a Superman pose conceptualized by Nick Carty. So double your Aquaman right there.
Look at that. That's, wow. I can't believe I missed that name entirely. That's amazing. I had no idea he went back that far with DC Comics. No,
I didn't either.
That Aquaman miniseries was 86, not that, and I knew that he worked on Who's Who, which was like 84, 85, but yeah, I didn't know he went all the way back to 1978. Cool. All right. Good on you, Neil Posner. Nice job, man. All right. So anyway, yeah, we have all the stuff about Krypton, and in this opening chapter, there's even a still from the movie that was not in the movie, which is them talking to like the Kryptonian enforcer guy that looks like kind of a tin-plated stormtrooper.
Yes. It's the scene where they are sending him to kill Jor-El.
Right. Yeah.
Some of the extended cuts of the movie, and there's also a scene earlier that you see. Do you see that in? There's so many cuts of the movies now. I'm getting confused, but it's not as bad as Blade Runner. But
no.
But you see in some versions, you see Non, like, I think it's Non, like, snaps one of their necks and they're trying to, like, and then they capture the Phantom Zone villains and then that's when they start sentencing them.
Right,
and
I remember that, yeah.
I don't know if that's in some versions of Superman 2 or, it's been a long time since I've seen Superman 2. So these guys, they definitely have a stormtrooper-like look, but people that got this book and were wanting to see them in the theatrical cut, you're not going to see him.
I think it's even in this scene, like, they use those rings to literally teleport the guy.
Yes.
He does, like, he disappeared there because I think it's Harry Andrews is like, the law must be upheld. And they beam him over. So, yeah, they're pretty strict here on Krypton. Like, you disagree with the Science Council, they're going to, I guess, execute you. Like, well, may not execute because they don't have the death penalty as established in Superman 2, but they're going to do something pretty severe to Jor-El.
Right, they're gonna send you to the Phantom Zone.
Yeah.
Which that he'd be in there with Zod, that'd be great.
Yeah, pretty bad. But yeah, no, I like the throughout this book that they are constantly comparing it to the comics. I think that's a great. I think this is a nice feature. It's reminding everybody, hey, you know, these things come from the comics. This is not just, you know, the movie. It's you know, it came from somewhere. The established continuity and all the looks and stuff like that. So I dig all that, and they do that throughout. Where they're pulling different panels. A lot of this stuff is by Wayne Boring and Kurt Swan and Kurt Schaffenberger. That's really the main guys that they pull from.
Yeah, and it's interesting. If you read the text on Krypton, it's really more the comic book version because it talks about how internal pressures are building up and the core is turning to uranium. Well, that's a version of the comic book Krypton because in the movie, the Red Sun is actually what blows up and then blows the planet up. You know,
right.
I mean, so it's kind of interesting. And in fact, I went back and looked, and Michael Fleischer and Joe Orlando and Jack Harris worked on the copy and everything in this treasury. And Michael Fleischer wrote the Great Superman book, which was actually supposed to be volume 3 of his Encyclopedia of Comic Book Heroes series. He did Batman, Wonder Woman, and then by the time Superman come out, it came out around the time of this movie, and they called it the Great Superman book, I guess, so it could sell on its own and cash in on the movie. And a lot of this text is very similar to his entry on Superman's origin or on Krypton in that book. So, I mean, he basically, I think Fleischer was basically taking, transcribing his stuff from his entries from that into this. So,
hey, why not?
Yeah, sure. It's laying around. Why not use it? You know, it's what he's getting paid twice for it, right?
Yeah.
And speaking of that, one thing I want to bring up, I never had this book either. I remember seeing the ads for it. But I did have another book that Joe Orlando and Michael Fleischer worked on that's called The Great Superman Movie Book. It's a Scholastic book that you would get like from a book fair at school, and that's where I got it. And it's by them, by those two guys. Now, Jack C. Harris isn't involved, but those two guys went on and also worked on the Superman II Treasury. And it's very much like – it's like a young reader's version of these treasuries. And it's a lot of the same photos, some of the same text. It very much feels similar. So when I finally got – and I got the Superman 2 one off the stands, but the Superman 2 Treasury. But when I picked this book up as a kid, I had several different versions. In fact, this version's a later one that actually has some Superman 3 segments in it. But when I picked this up off the at the first one at a comic book shop or something, it kind of all clicked together that, oh, wait, these are all by the same people. That's why all this – some of the same artworks use some of the same comic panels. And so there's a lot of recycling going on. But that's okay. You know, it's going into different markets and
– Yeah.
Yeah. So this – mine is dog-eared all the hell, but I still got it from like –
Oh, that's great. You still have that same copy? That's fantastic.
Yes, from like third grade or whatever it was.
that's awesome. I love that stuff. That's great. So the next section is Smallville, home of the Kent family, and we have a little nice shot of Glenn Ford as Pa and Phyllis Thaxter as Ma, and then there's a really nice photo of Kirk Allen and Noelle Neal together, and then them with the young actress who plays Lois Lane, and then a reverse shot of them in the train, which is not a shot that is featured in the movie, even... it's in the director's cut is the close, because that's right. Where they actually get their lines. But I really like that portrait of Noelle Neal and Kirk Allen. I think that's very sweet.
Yeah, it's really nice. I like that. I like that one a lot. It's funny they mention their names, but they don't mention the name of the actress that played young Lois Lane.
No, they don't. Yeah, we have to look her up, see if she ever did anything of them. Next is the Great Superman Movie Contest, which of course ran in the back matter of DC Comics for like 2 years practically. And there's this photo of Jeanette Kahn and Saul Harrison with Christopher Reeve going through all the entries. And you see there's like all the tons of envelopes. Right behind him is the Superman doing the peace sign poster. I love that thing. I love Superman. Peace out, everybody. That's really funny. And then we have the photo of the two contest winners. The two kids who won the contest. Tim Hussey and Ed Finneran. And they're in their football uniforms because they played... They got to do walk-ons in the movie during the Smallville scene. And it's the picture of them holding up another Superman treasury, which I love this photo. I mean, anytime I can get a photo of kids reading a treasury comic in the wild, I just go nuts. So I love this photo.
I love it, too. And I love that. I love the cover of that treasury, which, of course, is that H.J. Ward famous painting of Superman that actually hung in the D.C. offices for years. And I don't know. It might still hang in the D.C. offices. I don't know. So that I've always loved that cover. And oddly enough, some of this Superman origin that you see here, like the 70s version, you see like on the next page with the rocket leaving Krypton and landing in the Kent's near the Kent's truck. That's actually reprinted in that treasury. And it originated in that Amazing World of Superman book that DC released when Metropolis, Illinois became
a
thing.
Right.
So it's kind of neat that here's the book that this came from, like the, you know, on the opposite page. It's all connected. It all, as Michael Bailey would say, it all comes back to Superman.
Of course. Did you enter the contest? I never did.
I didn't. I think I was too young. I probably couldn't have, you know, I'm sure that's something my mom had to read me the comics at the time. I was, you know, I couldn't read yet. So when this came out, so I'm sure she didn't, you know, say, oh, look, you can enter a Superman contest. Here's more work for me to do. So, I didn't. But I remember, you know, I remember the the ads for it, you know, now looking back, I did, you know, in the comics, I noticed the ads for it in the comics, and there was the first one, and then there was the second one after that. Of course, you didn't win a part in the movie, but you won a bunch of prizes and stuff. And I love this picture of Jeanette Kahn, the very 70s portrait of Jeanette Kahn in her 70s.
She's styling. I like she is styling. She looks great.
Yeah, she does. I mean, I think she was kind of a fashionista anyway, from what I understand. So, you know, she's there. And it's always weird to see Chris Reeve kind of in semi-Superman mode.
No, yeah.
In normal clothes. It looks like he just come out of the chamber in Superman 2, you know. He's about to get his ass kicked by a trucker, you know. Oh, man. Oh, good stuff.
Yeah, I like that. Those are great. Seeing him at the DC offices is cool. I dig. You know, it's kind of funny that they don't do contests anymore. Like, you don't ever see that. And consider Marvel could be doing a contest every dad blame month, you know, if they wanted to do a movie related contest. But I guess they figure that's like an antiquated thing that nobody really does. Nobody really wants to bother with that anymore. I mean, maybe they do them and I'm just not aware of it. But like, you don't see blurbs on any Marvel comics saying, hey, enter the Thor Ragnarok contest.
Right. I've seen them elsewhere. Like, you know, like videos pop up. Mm-hmm. Hey, enter the, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 contest. You can win a, right, you know, trip to the premiere, but it's not in the comics. And yeah. I almost guarantee, because he is such a good sport about things, Henry Cavill would get involved with something like this. He seems like a really good sport about these type of things. So, hey, DC, you're missing out, you know?
Win a chance to have Superman snap your neck in the new Superman movie contest.
You can shave Henry Cavill's mustache.
There would be a lot of women and gay dudes that would sign up for that. That would be a huge. I know you're making a joke, but that would probably get a lot of entries. I'm just saying. I think that would.
My mom was so in love with Christopher Reeve, I'm surprised she didn't enter this contest. That's all I'm saying.
That'd be funny. Yeah, there's young Mama Frankel with Christopher Reeve. She's like,
she loved him, and Somewhere in Time was her absolute favorite movie.
Oh,
so.
Right. Hell yeah. Yeah. That was weird. Okay. Then we have a page of four pages from Superman comics, where we see him in the rocket. We see him as a baby in the nursery, and he's flipping the doctor around because he's got super strength flying around. And then, of course, the later on where we see Pa Kent dying. I always wondered, how did the Kents keep that doctor quiet?
I don't know.
The one that saw, you know, he sees, there's a doctor and a nurse, and they see baby Cal flying around the nursery. How did whatever happened to those two, you know? Like, how did they talk them, like, please, ixnay on the reveal, you know? Like, what is that
the
about?
Dark secret of Pa Kent, you know?
Yeah, he killed him. There you go.
Yeah, Kevin Costner, you can buy that. I mean, the way he was. Glenn Ford, no way. But Kevin Costner, oh, yeah, he did it. Right, yeah. There's. But, yeah, you know, it's funny. If Superman isn't ever Superboy, then you can kind of, I mean, still, yeah, they saw a flying kid, okay, but they might not necessarily put two and two together if Superman never appeared in Smallville in any way, but if Superboy shows up 8 years later or whatever,
this is not, you don't need to be Encyclopedia Brown to figure that one out.
Exactly.
So then we move on to the Fortress of Solitude, Superman's secret sanctuary. It features this really cool schematic of the comics fortress, first level, second level. And this was the kind of thing they used to get, like, Marshall Rogers to draw for Who's Who and all these. And I used to love this stuff. I was always more of a Batman kid than a Superman kid. But, man, the Fortress of Solitude was just so sweet. And just seeing all the details and all the stuff that he has in there, the monitor rooms, the archives, the supercomputer. I just thought this stuff was just boss. It was so cool.
I'm thinking this came from somewhere else, but I can't place it. And it might have been, I think, from that same Superman treasury we were talking about that had the H.J. Ward cover. I think that is it that one that's got the feature on the proposed Superman amusement park?
I'd have to go back and look. I should know this by heart, but I don't. I believe it is, but I can't swear to that because there were some other Superman treasuries. I forget which one it's in there, which one it has it.
Yeah, because I know I've got that one, and I think it's that one. And maybe this was, you know, it just makes me wonder if this wasn't done for that proposed project or something. Because I know Neil Adams, and this looks like Continuity Studios work.
Yes,
and I know, and I know he did a lot of work for that proposed Superman Land amusement park, which unfortunately never came to be in near Metropolis, Illinois. Which Illinois is really neat, and I recommend any Superman fan go there, especially during the Superman celebration if you've never been. Have you ever been to it,
Rob? I have not. I have not.
That should be a future Fire and Water get together.
I was about to say, yeah, that we should. That's not a bad suggestion at all. That's a pretty cool. I mean, can you imagine if there had been a Superman Land? That would be geek mecca. You know,
yes,
just, it would be unbelievable what that would be. You could have expanded on it. Could have had like a Batman wing. That would have all been super cool stuff, man. I'm getting depressed just thinking about it.
I know it.
Then we move on to the Daily Planet, and we see Clark Kent and Perry White and Lois Lane, Margot Kidder looking quite ravishing as Lois. There's a reprint from a 1938 Superman comic, the first appearance of Lois, where we see that she slaps a guy. She's not taking any crap from anybody, even at an early age. Perry White, with his cape, the Caped Wonder, stuns City. And then another shot of Mark McClure as Jimmy Olsen. And then there's a page from a 1960 comic drawn by Kurt Schaffenberger, someone who I will admit, like, I had the tough when I was a kid, I didn't really like, but now I see his stuff and I love it. Like, I love the way he draws this stuff. So I'm glad that they use that here because it's really pretty to look at.
I like Schaffenberger because I really like the Mr. and Mrs. Superman feature drew in Superman Family, and then he drew that, and then he drew the New Adventures of Superboy comic, and I like that. So I kind of got. His style is super consistent. It's almost like an animation model sheet design that he just follows. It's so consistent. I mean, he's really, Kurt Swan's kind of like that too, but his work's a little more illustrative. Kurt Schaffenberger stuff is so, it's so slick. It's just like polished, super polished.
Yeah, really beautiful, beautiful stuff. So after that, we move on to different little profiles of all the characters. So, of course, we start with Superman. We have some shots of Christopher Reeve. We have the one you've talked about where he's pointing into the sky. Then there's a full-page color shot of him in Luthor's hideout where he looks like he wants to melt Luthor with his heat vision. That's a great, great shot.
Yeah.
And then we have these little headshots comparing all the characters. So we see Margot Kidder next to the comic book version. We have that for Perry White. Lex Luthor, his first appearance here in the book. Superman. I love that little photo of Christopher Reeve. He looks spooky. That shadowy shot of Superman. What is that about?
I think that's from the gauntlet scene. That's not in the movie until you saw it on TV. And then it's in the director's cut. It looks like he's in the shadows of Luthor's lair as he's coming toward him. That'd be my guess. That's a
funny photo. We have a reproduction of Action Comics #1. Then we move on to Lex Luthor, his lair. We see some interactions of Superman and him in the comics. Then we get on to Luthor's henchmen. We have a tiny little photo of Ned Beatty and then a giant photo of Valerie Perrine. The 9-year-old me thanks DC Comics for this. It's funny. I saw this movie when I was a kid. I saw it when I was 7. And I have really still kind of distinct memories of when I was a child. I knew I liked Miss Tessmacher. I didn't know why I did, but I knew that I did.
Right.
And I should probably save this anecdote for the Superman movie minute when we get to it, but what the hell. I'll say it twice. In the audio commentary that Richard Donner and Tom Mankiewicz did for the movie, the very first scene in the movie where Valerie Perrine shows up and they put her in all these amazing outfits, there's this momentary bit of silence, and then you just hear Richard Donner say, "She was really put together."
She was, yeah, yeah. Well said, Rich. Leave it to Richard Donner, just to put it so succinctly. Yeah
pretty much.
And,
yeah, it
was and still thing. Pretty classy, even though, what he's saying. He still said it in pretty classy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's another photo of her in the red dress where she poses, and again, she looks just phenomenal. And then we have a great shot of Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor, and I love that we see the detail in the background behind Luthor, the photo of Mussolini. I think that was such a great set dressing that he of course likes Mussolini. Like, of course he does.
Of course. One thing I want to point out in Ned, in when it, the little picture of Otis, It's easy to get distracted by the picture of Valerie Perrine.
Especially since Ned Beatty's looking in that direction.
Yeah, Ned Beatty's looking straight at what we're looking at. And it says, abetted by his two amply evil assistants, Eve, his wickedly seductive mistress, and Otis, his bumbling but scientifically brilliant henchman.
Yeah.
What? Did they see a different movie than I did? You know,
that version of Otis clearly didn't make it into the final script.
You see a long arm, Otis.
Yeah, he can't even get the numbers right. What the hell are they talking about? Yeah. Do we ever hear Miss Tessmacher's first name? I can't recall that we do. I think he just calls her Miss Tessmacher, and Superman calls her Miss Tessmacher. I don't think we ever hear her say Eve.
No, and I think through this book, they don't call her Miss Tessmacher. They call her Eve. More than they call her Eve, and I'm like, who the heck? Oh yeah, Miss Tessmacher. Okay.
You can't picture Gene Hackman yelling Eve, like it just doesn't have the same oomph to it the way he does Miss Tessmacher. He really makes a meal out of yelling Miss Tessmacher.
Oh yeah, I mean it's so wonderful. Just the sound he makes as he says it through his teeth as he's screaming.
absolutely love it. So then we have some other scenes of Superman in action. There's a scene from him from the gauntlet scene, which you just talked about, where that mm-hmm. whole sequence was cut, where we see Superman melt things with heat vision and survive with the – he gets frozen and all that stuff, again, eventually came out. And then we have a page of storyboards, and I love seeing this stuff. I'm a big fan of seeing movie storyboards just because, to me, they're really fascinating. And, like, in another life, I would have, like, pursued this as a career because I think – this work looks really interesting to me. And, you know, Hitchcock did storyboards and Spielberg did storyboards, but I would think that doing storyboards for a superhero movie has got to be kind of the easiest gig of all because it's just like doing a comic book. I mean, I wouldn't have minded if they had done a book of the storyboards. Like, that would have been cool to see, just the whole movie done in almost comic book form.
Right, yeah, and it looks like this sequence, which is Superman saving the bus full of kids – They really followed it really close.
Yeah.
I mean I mean it looks like almost shot for shot what's in the movie, which is really because sometimes you'll see it and they kind of followed it. Like there's a lot of storyboards I've seen from the first Batman movie, the Tim Burton Batman movie, and it's a little close, but it's not it's nowhere near as exact as this is. So whoever did this, they really must have done a good job according to Donner, and he just followed it because it's dead on what's on screen.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful stuff. And now we move on to the behind-the-scenes crew, and we have the executive producer. We're talking about Ilya Salkind and his father, Alexander Salkind, plus Pierre Spengler. I'm still not familiar exactly what Pierre Spengler did.
He pissed off Richard Donner.
Right, other than that, yeah, we know he did that, yeah. Donner calls him Star-Spangled Spengler. He called him that in the commentary. Yeah, I don't know what role Pierre Spengler plays. We know what the Salkinds did. Weirdly, I am friends with Ilya Salkind on Facebook. He just friended me one day. I was like, what? Like, how does he even know who I am? Like, that's weird. So, yeah,
cool.
It's a very weird thing. We'll have to talk about him, tell him about we're doing this show. And then we have the director, the man, Richard Donner. A portrait of him smoking a cigarette and then him on the set. And it says, it doesn't give his name at the top. It just says the director. And next to each of these people's names, it will have a pull quote. And Donner's pull quote is, Superman must be treated straight. Amen, brother. Like, that is the ultimate creative decision that turned this movie around from the Mario Puzo, Kojak cameoing camp version to the classic that we have today. So, again, I know throughout the show, throughout Superman Movie Minute, we are going to be waxing Richard Donner's car to a fine, fine shine. But it cannot be stated enough. Everything you like about Superman, the movie, can be traced to that original decision.
Yes, most definitely. It's you can't overstate that, in my opinion. And we probably will come close to overstating it, but we really can't.
You may not be able to do it, but we're going to get damn close. So then we see scenes of him on the set directing. We see him with Gene Hackman. We see him with Marlon Brando. And it's kind of funny. Like, you look at that costume that Brando is wearing, and it looks so cheap and so cheesy. And then when you see it on screen, it just looks phenomenal because, of course, it was made of all this reflective material that once you lit it, it would light up and it looks fantastic. But when you see it, you know, not lit properly, it looks like it's from a 1950s B science fiction movie.
Oh, yeah. And it looks like it's been crumpled up in a corner because of all the fragmented, you know, pieces of that glass that's like sewn into the fabric or whatever. And it's interesting because I know there's a behind the scenes shot in one of the making of documentaries. I don't know if it's like the original one or one of the newer ones that was, you know, released on DVD and Blu-ray. But it shows Susanna York she's in the outfit and the lights are down and then they turn the lights up and you see it transform. And so luckily they knew it didn't suck. You know, it wasn't like a post-production thing where you're like, well, they're going to fix this in post. You know, luckily they had confidence knowing, okay, this really does look really good. So, you know, because I mean, I would imagine if they, as bad as it looks in this picture, you know, they might have some trouble getting behind that if it really did look that bad on screen. I love the picture of Richard Donner talking to Jack O'Halloran there. Yes. I mean, it looks like he's really just like, look, Jack, I need you to calm down, okay? Just, you know, like, it just take it easy. That's what it kind of looks like.
Halloran,
I don't know.
Halloran looks terrifying. He really does.
He does.
And behind it, there's a two-page splash, and it's a sketch, just like a loose sketch of the – it says an artist's view of a camera crew at work on a Daily Planet sequence in New York City is provided, top left, by noted DC Comics artist Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Praise be his name. Yeah. Now here it just doesn't. It drops to Louise. It just says Jose Garcia Lopez. But yeah, we see this nice sketch of people hard at work. So I guess Jose was doing some sort of stuff for the movie. I didn't know any of that. So that's really cool too.
And a lot of people have said over the years how much his Superman is very much a Christopher Reeve like Superman. But it's kind of just a coincidence because he'd already started drawing Superman like that before Christopher Reeve became Superman. Mm-hmm. So it's just a happy accident that they've kind of got he just had that Christopher Reeve look. Of course, Christopher Reeve looks like Superman, but you know, I mean, he really looks like Garcia Lopez's Superman.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. And then there's another set of sketches by Rick Estrada, the Superman crew at work, and we see Donner on the camera and the camera rig, and then doing all this kind of stuff. Then we go on to Marlon Brando. Now Marlon Brando's quote is, "We must preserve the myth." There is no way Marlon Brando said that. That is totally made up. Marlon Brando didn't give a rat's ass about any of this stuff. He took this movie for the money and for his kids because his kids wanted to be – he wanted to be in a movie his kids could see. So there's no way Brando – that quote's just completely made up.
I do believe he said there's no point in hanging pumpkins on a morning glory because it makes absolutely no sense and sounds like most of the nonsensical stuff he normally said in interviews.
Yeah, so there's no. I mean, I appreciate them trying to make Marlon Brando sound like he was on board with all this stuff, but no, he never said that, so that's fine.
I'm surprised he didn't have the thing about the bagel or the suitcase.
Yeah, the green suitcase or the space bagel or whatever, yeah. I do enjoy that in the Marlon Brando write-up, it does mention The Last Tango in Paris. So
yeah.
This is a DC comic book which mentions an X-rated movie. So that probably would never happen again. Maybe nowadays they do it. But back then, it was still a big deal. What I imagine being a little kid and going, "Hey, Mom, what's The Last Tango in Paris?" What?
I mean, like, he was like, one reason they couldn't shoot, what was it, in Italy or something, was because Brando was wanted for, because they filmed, wherever they filmed Last Tango in Paris, he couldn't go back and film again because he was actually wanted for, like, you know, violating pornography laws or something. I mean,
yeah,
it was
something like that. Yeah.
It was crazy. So, I mean, the movie, like, actually made him an outlaw in, like, at least one country. And then they mentioned it in this comic book treasury.
I love that. That's a great detail. I love that. So now we have Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor. And his quote is, "I really started in this business because of Brando." And that's something, it's funny, in the commentary track, they talk about that. They talk about that a lot of the actors were intimidated to be in scenes with Brando. Now, of course, Gene Hackman doesn't ever have any scenes with Brando. But Christopher Reeve does, and Terrence Stamp does. And they talk about that those guys were intimidated because it was Marlon Brando, you know, and it's something you don't necessarily think about. And because we're not going to get to that scene in Superman Movie Minute, because it's a scene from the director's cut, I will mention it here, where the one scene that Christopher Reeve has directly with Marlon Brando is where he, after he saves Lois for the first time, he goes back to the Fortress of Solitude and does the whole thing about, ask me any question, my son. And Superman says, who am I? And that whole scene, apparently, they said Donner watched Christopher Reeve, like, preparing, you know, and he's like, who am I? Who am I? Like, he was running through it. And Brando was there live on the set. It wasn't dropped in post later. And so anyway, they wait, and they get to the scene, and Brando says, if you have a question, my son, you know, speak. And Christopher Reeve goes, who am I? And Brando goes, is it how you're going to do it? And then they said, everybody started laughing, and Tom Hankwood says, Chris Reeve turned into the color of a Coke machine. He was so embarrassed. He was just like, he felt bad that Marlon Brando was making fun of his acting. They were like, no, we're just kidding around. But he said that was the moment. We're just like, oh, man, did they have your hero kind of be like, that's how you're going to read that line, dude? Like,
oh, jeez. Oh, man. Yeah, that, you know, it would be. I mean, when you, especially having him just come off The Godfather, I mean, he had his reputation in the 50s, of course, and coming up as the top actor. And I know he had some kind of down periods, which they mention in this book. But I mean, he'd come back swinging with The Godfather, and that. So I mean, this was Marlon Brando at his zenith, really, and as far as, you know, prestige of an actor. And then it would be very intimidating to share space with him, plus because of his reputation of being pretty odd too. You're probably
a difficult,
like,
guy, no doubt.
Yeah,
difficult
how's guy. This guy going to react to anything I say? You know, so.
Yeah. So then we have portraits, set of Christopher Reeve as Superman and Margot Kidder as Lois Lane. I love that photo of her with the pen in her mouth. I think looking quizzical. I love that photo. I think it's just terrific. Ned Beatty. Great. Jackie Cooper, Glenn Ford, Trevor Howard, who again inexplicably gets such a large chunk of kind of space, considering he has like two lines in the movie. But he was a big name, and it was kind of a big get. But it's just sort of funny when you see him, and then another page later, Maria Schell getting these large features when they are barely in the movie, at least compared to everybody else.
Right, and then of course Valerie Perrine to outdo your Last Tango in Paris reference, it mentions that she was a topless dancer in Vegas.
I guess they figured that, you know, maybe little kids weren't going to buy this because it wasn't a comic book adaptation. Maybe they figured this was maybe more for the teen audience that were interested in this kind of stuff.
Right, right. Yeah, but yeah, just think about that after the pictures in this book. Okay, we'll move on.
Yeah, like, good Lord. So then we have little features on Terrence Stamp, Phyllis Thaxter, Susanna York, and then we move on to the production designer, John Barry, the brilliant, brilliant, brilliant John Barry, who did work for both Superman the movie and Star Wars, which is, I mean, Jiminy Christmas.
You know? 2 years in a row and just retire, you know, basically.
I mean, that's and he also worked on A Clockwork Orange. I don't even mean to dismiss that. I mean, talk about just brilliant. This guy was just utterly, utterly. And the fact, when you think about all of this was done, you know, by hand for reels, you know,
yep.
This was all built on stages somewhere. Unbelievable, unbelievably brilliant guy.
Yeah. And it's interesting that he, even in this, he mentions a lot of things, or a lot of discussions had about. Nowadays, you hear people say, well, the reason that the prequels, they don't look right is because the universe isn't lived in like the original Star Wars trilogy. You know, it's too clean. It, you know, even I know it's earlier and it's before the Empire takes over, but it's just too clean. And that's one thing everybody liked about Force Awakens. It looks lived in. But he mentions that here. He mentions that, you know, it had a gritty realism, a lived in look. We wanted Krypton to look, you know, pristine. And, you know, so it's. That's nothing new. I mean, they knew that when they did it. It wasn't an accident that they made Star Wars look live in and then made Superman look antiseptic, you know, Krypton.
Yep.
I think that was interesting because that's, you know, that's something that people trout out today is, oh, that's one thing that made Star Wars so real and so believable is it felt like you were in a real universe that existed. Well, that's John Barry. There you go.
Brilliant guy. And then we have costume designer Yvonne Blake, and we see her at work with some drawings in the background. Funnily enough, you see a comic book pinned to her wall, and it's an issue of Super Team Family.
Yeah.
Could DC not find a Superman comic lying around to send her? Like, why would you send her Super Team Family? You know, we only have 19 Superman books that we publish every month, but for some reason, she's got an issue of Super Team Family, though.
Which I own that issue, and you'll be happy to know it reprints the first composite Superman story from World's Finest.
I'm very excited. Maybe they were maybe they were hoping to get him into the movie or something. I don't know.
There you go.
Yeah. That's they needed secret reference for that. And then we see shots of her drawings compared to the final versions. We see Superman and then Ursa, who looks great. I love the drawing of Ursa. That's like a really cool drawing. And then Jor-El. And we see that, you know, by these final versions, they got pretty, you know, pretty close to what her drawings look like in terms of visualizing them.
She was the first to try to put that S on Superman's belt buckle in that drawing, though, and it didn't make it into the costume.
Look at that. Oh, I didn't even notice that. Yeah.
Huh. It would finally make it into Superman Returns. He'd have the S on his belt buckle. One thing that stands out with Ursa's outfit is you can really see the red piping and the kind of red leather accents. And that's something that you really don't notice in the movie that much. But Mattel made a 12-inch General Zod figure about 10 years ago, and they went way overboard on the red, and people – there was a big brouhaha over it because it's like, well, that's not right. That's not screen accurate. And then they, like, produced some photos and said, look, it was
suck
red.
Suck it, nerds.
You know? Suck it, nerds. It was red. Well, it's not that red. You know, it's got like it's a maroon, you know, more than red.
Cool. I didn't even realize that. And then we have a little feature on John Williams, of course. We've say this on episodes of Superman Movie Minute, but, you know, hard pressed to say one theme from John Williams is better than the rest because he did so many great ones. I would argue that of the four, I would say the four peerless achievements in terms of scores, Jaws, Star Wars, Superman and Raiders, I think Superman's the best one. I think by a percentile, like 26, 24, 24, 24. But I would give Superman the nod in terms of just to me it is literally conjures the character in your mind when you hear that. It's just nothing else but Superman.
Yeah, I mean, like Donner said, it says his name, you know. Yeah. He heard the word Superman without anybody speaking it. And I do. I think, as much as I love all his work, and like you said, those four being his, the zenith of his many achievements, and I mean, maybe we're too close, but you know, maybe we're too close to, but you're also close to all. I mean, I like all, of course, I love all three of those movies, other three movies, but you're really close to them. So for you to say that it's Superman, I think it's got more weight than for me to say it's Superman. Cause I'm I'm much less of a nerd for those other movies, and much more of a Superman nerd versus you're a nerd for all four.
True. Yeah. My nerdiness spreads across far and wide across many movies. Yeah. They're all masterpieces, those four scores. And the fact when you think that he composed them all in a 5-year period.
Oh.
I mean, that just sort of boggles the mind. I mean, you're a creative person, I'm a creative person. That level of being that creatively on fire is you shake your head at it. Yeah, you're just like, how did anybody be that good? And he did other movies in between all those movies too. It wasn't like he just sat around. He did a bunch of other movies, too. It just happened to work when he's working on these giant tentpole franchise movies. He just rose to the occasion, man. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So,
The next year he did the Dracula, the Frank Langella Dracula. Oh, wow. And I think that's an underrated score. I really like that one a lot.
It's amazing guy. Amazing guy. So, and then there's one more shot of Christopher Reeve. This is like a kind of a sepia-toned shot of him. Clearly
I love
from that same
shot.
Yeah, it's a nice shot. Clearly from that same photo shoot. I love the heavy shadows. This feels like something that, like, Alex Ross would have done, you know? Like, it has that kind of very heavy, shadowy kind of look to it.
Yes. I don't see this one very often. And I really – in fact, this might be the only place I've really seen it. I was going to point out, I forgot, there's like a center spread, like a poster that you can basically rip out in the middle of the book that's Superman flying. That's the exact, with the background blurred, that's the exact same image that's on the inside of the original Superman soundtrack album. When you open it up, it's like a, you know, it's a double album, or maybe it's four albums. I can't remember. I think it's double. I've got it, but I can't. I think it's double. But you open it up, it's the exact same photo. So great minds think alike, apparently.
Cool. All right. And then we have the inside back cover, which we have already explained. If I have the wrong version, or Chris has the wrong version, I'm not sure.
I bet you I have the wrong version, because it would make more sense for the credits like that to be at the end of it. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm staring at Valerie Perrine in her bikini outfit.
Yeah, oh.
Yeah. And then the back cover is a great shot of Superman in front of the American flag, which was, you know, again, a key to this movie's appeal, because you got to think, when this movie was made, 1976, 77, we are just a year or two out of Watergate. We're involved in the worst corruption in the White House since, well, you know. we're involved with something very, very, you know, we're in an amazingly cynical time. Lois Lane has that line about, you know, you're going to have to arrest every member of Congress kind of thing. And here is this movie explicitly putting Superman as an American icon and sort of trying to remind people, you know, the good parts of being, you know, part of truth, justice in the American way kind of thing. And it's Christopher Reeve was, damn it, he was able to sell it. He does. Yes. He looks inspiring here in his costume.
Yes, he does. And like we've mentioned many times, the magic of Christopher Reeve, that he completely pulled off that character and, you know, in that time, with other characters pointing out that we are in such a cynical time. And they didn't hide from it. They embraced it head on. He was that beacon of light, that beacon of hope. He never looked self-conscious in that costume. And in all these still photos, he just looks great. I mean, he's selling it even when he's not even acting.
Yep.
Just the way he's standing and looking, he sells Superman. I mean, you know, not every actor does that in any role, let alone a role where you have to pull off that costume. So,
yep.
You know, again, we can't, just like Donner, we can't say enough good things about Christopher Reeve either. And we will not stop saying those either, I'm sure, when we finally get to his arrival on screen in the film.
Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of Christopher Reeve, it's a good segue. Not that we needed one, because this whole show is a commercial. But Chris and I were looking for a long time, like, what would be a good day to release the show for the first time. And we had first talked about waiting all the way until December of this year, the way that would mark the 39th anniversary of the release of the movie. But people were really been asking us, when are you going to do it? When are you going to do it? And we were like, we've been having so much fun doing these shows. We really want to get them out. So we decided, finally found an appropriate date, which was, as we said, is Monday, September 25th, which is whose birthday, Chris?
Christopher Reeve.
There you go. You can't beat that. I can't think of a better way to sort of honor Christopher Reeve than starting the show on his birthday, because he is my Superman. He's Chris's Superman. Mm-hmm. And so we figure it's just a perfect day. So that's going to be the release. That's going to be the first episode of Superman Movie Minutes. The show will come out weekly, where we analyze the movie 5 minutes at a time, with a little bit of a different version of the movie by minutes format than other shows do, but we're doing it five minutes at a time. We will be featuring some guests here and there on some episodes, and Chris and I have already said we've already recorded a bunch of shows, and we've been having a lot of fun. I've said to Chris virtually every time, like, it is so easy to talk about this movie. It is just effortless to just make notes and talk about stuff. So I'm really excited for everybody to finally get to hear it and seeing what everybody's feedback is and continuing on through the movie. We haven't at this recording, we haven't even gotten to Superman yet. He hasn't even shown up yet.
Right.
And we're still having so much fun. So I'm really looking forward to Superman Movie Minute.
Oh, yeah, me too. I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's – so far, I mean, it is. It's just, I mean, I like talking to you anyway, Rob, obviously. It's a subject that I can talk to anybody. I mean, and people probably, you know, most people probably after a while want me to shut up about it. But it's nice to have somebody to talk to about it that doesn't mind me going on and on talking about it. So it's fantastic, and I love it.
Yeah, this is super cool. And so this is a nice book. It's a nice souvenir. I would have loved to have had an actual movie adaptation but that wasn't in the cards. Thank you, Mario Puzo. But as a souvenir, as the kind of thing that, you know, in an age where the movie wasn't going to necessarily, there was no such thing as home video. You had to wait until it played on television or something. You wanted a keepsake. And this is a really good keepsake. I've been joking at virtually every episode of Treasury Cast. Why doesn't Marvel do these? You know, like, why doesn't Marvel do it for every movie? Why isn't there a Thor Treasury Edition? Why isn't there an Avengers? Why isn't there, Spider-Man Homecoming? They should do that. I think there's something very valuable, very fun about that. So I'm glad that this book exists.
Well, you know, it's interesting, too, because I know over the years they have mentioned several times, like when the Batman movie adaptation, the Denny O'Neill, Jerry Ordway adaptation, the original idea was to have that sold in movie theaters, you know, as a souvenir. And why aren't these being sold? Because in movie theaters now, you know, aren't they doing Treasury? Marvel's obviously doing Treasuries. Why aren't they selling them in the movie theater? Because when we went and saw Spider-Man Homecoming, I don't know about you, but there was actually like a kiosk full of Spider-Man stuff, T-shirts and mugs and things you could buy. And same thing for Beauty and the Beast that we saw this year. And so there's no reason why, you know, Marvel shouldn't have a Thor Ragnarok Treasury for sale in the movie theater.
Yep.
And Justice League. I mean, you know, why not?
Yeah.
Why not just, you know, even if it's like this, even if it's not an adaptation, even it's a souvenir book like this would actually work better than an adaptation, because you just saw the movie, you know, and you're like, well, I just paid to see the movie. Why do I want to read it again? You know, but if it's something like this, it seems like that's like the perfect place to, and it'd make it available elsewhere too, of course.
Sure.
But that seems like a perfect place to actually sell it, you know, sell it at the, you know, and if you've got your, you know, your Cinemark app that gives you points when you go to the movies or whatever, then maybe you can, you know, use your points to get the book or something.
Yeah.
Seems like it makes a whole lot of sense to me, but you know, obviously I don't work for these theater chains, so I don't know.
We need to go work for Warner Brothers Marketing, Chris. We need to go talk to them. We'll offer those, both of us. We come as a package deal, guys. You got to hire us both. That's why.
That's right. So. Exactly.
All right. Very cool. So, I think that's going to wrap it up for Superman, the movie, all new collector's edition number C62. I want everybody to stay tuned, of course, through some promos, because I'm going to come back and do some listener feedback. But in the meantime, Chris, where can people find you on the network?
Oh, you don't have to look very far. I'm on the Supermates podcast with my wife, Cindy. I'm on Batman Nightcast with Ryan Daly. I do the Power Records podcast when you and I do it here. And Superman Movie Minute, of course, is coming. And occasionally I will do a Where Does He Get Those Wonderful Toys on Fire and Water Presents. And should be around the time that Superman Movie Minute launches, there hopefully will be a Wonderful Toys episode about some Superman the Movie merchandise.
Awesome. I can't wait for that. I love your toy episodes. That's going to be a blast. I can't wait to hear that.
Cool. I hope I get it done.
Well, no pressure. No pressure. So, all right, everybody. Well, Chris, thank you so much for coming back on. And I've been really having fun with Superman Movie Minute. And so, everybody, stay tuned. If you're listening to Treasury Cast on the day it comes out, and you should, because what else do we have to do? Superman Movie Minute will be out just 48 hours from now. But in the meantime, like I said, stick around for some podcast promos, and then I'll be back with some listener feedback.
My name is Bob Fisher, and I host a podcast called Superman Forever Radio. In every episode, I'll take an aspect of this character's long history and talk about it, from 1938 to the present day, from the comics, TV shows, movies, cartoons. Superman has been part of my life for over 50 years, and if you'd like to know why, join me for each and every episode of Superman Forever Radio. So point your favorite podcatcher to Superman Forever Radio. That's Superman Forever Radio. SupermanForever.com.
Andy, I have an amazing idea. Let's do a podcast.
We've been talking about doing this for years. That sounds great. So, what should we talk about?
Something no one else is talking about. Batman.
Mike, There are hundreds of Batman shows out there. You used to do one.
True. Well, maybe we could do an index show.
Are you insane? We both already host those.
True again. Okay, maybe we could talk about Batman stories no one else does. Like the Jerry Conway run.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, we could discuss his entire run and then go into the Doug Mensch run.
But we won't be tied down to that. We need to be free to talk about other Batman stories from that era as well.
And we could call it the Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show.
Great!
I guess we should do a trailer.
I think we kind of just did.
Yeah, but it's missing something. Like, you should have added music behind us or something.
Andy, I have an amazing idea. Let's do a podcast.
We've been talking about doing this for years. That sounds great! So, what should we talk about?
Something no one else is talking about. Batman.
Mike, there are hundreds of Batman shows out there. You used to do one.
True. Well, maybe we could do an index show.
Are you insane? We both already host those.
True again. Okay, maybe we could talk about Batman stories no one else does. Like the Jerry Conway run.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, we could discuss his entire run and then go into the Doug Mensch run.
But we won't be tied down to that. We need to be free to talk about other Batman stories from that era as well.
And we could call it the Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show.
Great!
The Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show. New episodes drop on the 14th and 28th of every month. The show and the website, www.overlookeddarknight.com, launch in May of 2017 from the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network.
Hey there, I'm Nathaniel with some exciting news about the Punch Like a Girl podcast. Oh, hey Liz, I'm just doing the promo. Tell the people about how the podcast we do together covering graphic novels and trade collections starring female protagonists is moving to, and actually I'm mansplaining again, aren't I?
Uh-huh.
Well, I can just, here you go.
Punch Like a Girl is joined in the Fire and Water Network, and as of October will be found on the network feed and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Is it okay if I just invite folks to join us in celebrating the girls who kick butt?
I think you already did.
Yes! Nailed it!
Don't worry, folks. I'll keep him in line.
And we're back with listener feedback. And first up, we have some iTunes reviews. New iTunes reviews always makes me very happy. We have one from someone called Master Villain from August 17th. It says, "The Joy of Treasuries, 5 stars. The Fire and Water Network has many great podcasts." Thank you, Master Villain. I agree. "But this one in particular really brightens my day. I was a kid in the 70s and didn't have a way to get these treasuries back then, but was always intrigued by them, and I was particularly obsessed with the Superman versus the Flash because I honestly thought it would settle the question of who was faster. I did eventually manage to find that one and many others since, and I completely relate to Rob's sense of wonder and admiration for the format. They were indeed the IMAX of Bronze Age comics, and I love the way this podcast celebrates that. Bravo." Thank you, Master Villain. Very much appreciated. And thanks to everybody who's left iTunes reviews. Please leave us more. Helps get the show noticed. So thank you very much. Now let's move on to the feedback found over on the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And this is the feedback for episode 17, which was the one I did with Zoom Yukinori on the limited collector's edition Dick Tracy by DC Comics. Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom podcast says, "I love hearing Zoom stories about his grandfather's life. I could go for some more of that." Yeah, me too. And hopefully with Zoom doing more shows for our network, we'll get to hear more stories of Zoom's family. That stuff is really terrific. Chuck Coletta says, "As a huge fan of Dick Tracy, I look forward to listening to this episode today in great anticipation. Bought the Dick Tracy flat top treasury sometime in the early 1980s when I started my deep dive into the Daring Detective. It's amazing how much blood and violence got into the newspapers back in the day. It's a shame, in a sense, that Gould was so willing to kill off his villains, but Flat Top has resurfaced over the years in the strip despite his demise. Early in his run, Max Allen Collins introduced Angel Top, Flat Top's little girl in a fun story where she attempts to avenge her father's death by trapping Tracy in a manner similar to how Flat Top dies in the story. Fans of Old Time Radio may also want to check out the all-star World War II-era command performance special, Dick Tracy in B-flat, which is a musical comedy take on the characters. The cast includes Bing Crosby, Dick Tracy, Bob Hope, Flat Top, Frank Sinatra, Shaky, Dinah Shore, Tess Trueheart, Judy Garland, Snowflake Falls, Frank Morgan, Vitamin Flintheart, Cass Daly, Greville Gerdy, Jimmy Durante, The Mole, and the Andrews Sisters as the Summer Sisters. I played that clip. That is amazing. I never knew that existed. And I just, it seems such a weird thing to have, like, the world of comic books. I mean, I know it's comic strips, but still, like, mixed in with these huge stars. That was just remarkable. Thanks so much for that, Chuck. That was just unbelievable to hear that. It was, like, so cool. I mean, Bing Crosby, Bob Hope, Frank Sinatra, Dinah Shore, Judy Garland. Wow. It was really, really cool. Ange from the Comic Box Commentary Supergirl blog says, I was thrilled when I saw this pop up. I got this treasury for my 7th or 8th birthday a couple of years after its release. I remember seeing it at the Woolworths near our house at the beach, and then I got it and read it over and over. Like you both say, the violence was so over the top that I felt like I was reading something I shouldn't be. The scene of the slingshot and the image of the drowned Flat Top are burned in my brain. But as you talked about other scenes, I could see the panels in my head, a sign that I read this thing to pieces. Ange, it's funny that you mentioned Woolworths specifically, because that was one of the stores that my dad used to take me to all the time to get me treasuries when I would go with him to his office on Saturdays, and he would buy me treasuries to sort of eat up the time while he got work done. That's funny that you mentioned that specific store, because remember they had a really great newspaper, like magazine rack, and they had treasuries. So that's you just mentioning Woolworths made all these memories flood right back to me. So thanks so much for the comment. James Williams writes, even though Fire and Water hosts my favorite podcast, I've never commented before because I'm visually disabled. I just wanted to say thank you for covering Dick Tracy. When I was a kid, my parents bought me the hardback book, The Celebrated Cases of Dick Tracy. I've never read anything like it before and reread the book countless times. For a long time afterwards, I cut out Dick Tracy from the newspaper and pasted it into a photo album. Thank you for bringing back so many happy memories. Thank you, James. That's a really wonderful comment. I'm glad that the Fire and Water Network can provide so much entertainment for you. That's fantastic. And yeah, it's funny. The whole idea of like cutting out newspaper strips and pasting them into books, that's the thing that, you know, nobody does anymore because there's hardly any comic strips. But I used to do that stuff too. I think I did it for the Spider-Man strip because it was, you know, it was like a big comic book. So that's really cool to see that other people did it too. Edo Bosnar says, great episode as usual. Enjoyed it thoroughly, even though I've never had this treasury book and know little about Dick Tracy other than what I've imbibed through popular culture, e.g. the Warren Beatty movie, the Duck Tracy Warner Brothers cartoon, etc. I also really enjoyed Zoom's opening reminiscences about his uncle Kenzo, whom he's mentioned in several other shows at this point, and his adventures in comics collecting. A very bittersweet story, and man, I wish I had an uncle like Kenzo. We all do, Ito. We all do. Uncle Kenzo sounds like the coolest dude in the world. Chris Franklin from our network, and of course the guest in this very episode, says, great episode, fellas. I remember seeing this advertised in a lot of old DC comics, which was probably my first exposure to Dick Tracy. Then I watched some of those truly awful 60s cartoons with all the racial stereotypes that were cringeworthy back then. Jiu-Jitsu, anyone? On WGN's Bozo show. There's a lot of back and forth on whether the Batman Rogues Gallery was really inspired by Dick Tracy villains. Most of Tracy's more outlandish foes appeared after or around the same time as the most famous of Batman's grotesque foes, although Kane and company definitely ripped off the blank for a character in the very early days of Batman's detective run. If I ever see this one out in the wild, I'll have to pick it up. Please do, Chris. I think it's super fun. If you can get it for, I'd say like 10, 15 bucks, totally worth it. Because it's like a trade paperback, so thanks for the comment. And, of course, thank you for being on today's show. Ward Hill Terry says, another great podcast. This tabloid was advertised in so many of the first comics I read. I've long been very interested in its contents. As others have stated, I thought that Flat Top was more than a one-adventure villain. My exposure to Dick Tracy was, like Chris, those awful cartoons. I saw them on the Uncle Gus show on WMUR in Manchester, New Hampshire. I was always disappointed that there wasn't enough Dick Tracy. It was always these other stupid cops. Yeah, that's funny. I had never seen the Dick Tracy cartoon until it was on VHS back at the video store that I worked at. And I was so excited. I was like, oh, a Dick Tracy cartoon? Cool. And I remember brought the first tape home. And not only, as Chris points out, it was all these awful racist stereotypes. It was like, it was just Dick Tracy just sitting on his ass, giving other people orders. I was like, what is this show? Like, it was completely baffling to me. So I was really disappointed. Ward Hill continues, Rob, you keep reeling me in a little tighter all the time. Now I'm going to the Film and Water Archives to hear your discussion about the Dick Tracy movie. Please do, Ward Hill. I think that's a great episode I did with Zoom. And I think I'd love maybe to do a Dick Tracy movie commentary episode. Even though Zoom and I covered the movie, I've been enjoying doing the commentary tracks. I started doing them with David Ace Gutierrez. And I think I'd like to do one for the Dick Tracy movie, because the more I think about it, kind of the more I really like that movie. And I think I'd like to talk over it. Ryan Daly from our network and Reese's dad says, I got the first volume of the complete collection that IDW published a couple of years ago. My dog chewed it to bits a week after we got her before I had a chance to read it. My dog did that for my hardcover book on Mad Magazine. So I feel you, Ryan. He says, so what's the deal with Dick Tracy's villain, Pouch? And then Chuck Coletta, man on the spot, comes in and says, believe it or not, but Pouch still makes sporadic appearances in the current Tracy strip. I don't think anyone considers him a first-tier rogue. Pouch probably does. But he debuted in the early 70s, shortly before The Treasury was published. He was a former obese man who lost a massive amount of weight. This led him to having lots of folds, pouches of excess skin. He would hide stolen items, weapons, etc. in the pouches. Goldman been running about ideas with this one. And then Chuck provides his entry for his pouches entry for the from the Dick Tracy Wikipedia page. That's hysterical. Brian Linton says, great episode, gentlemen. What I know of Dick Tracy comes primarily from the movie. So it was very interesting to learn more about his comic strip roots. In particular, I was intrigued to hear about the disposability of his rogues gallery. Quite a departure from modern comics, where we take it for granted that the villain will survive whatever horrible fate they appear to suffer. I don't think the Joker would have been able to escape Arkham so often if he lived in Dick Tracy's universe. Why do I want to see a Dick Tracy Batman team up all of a sudden? Because it would be an awesome idea. I wrote an article for Back Issue about this Dick Tracy trilogy, and I mentioned that it's such a shame that Dick Tracy had one shot in the DC universe, and so he never was around long enough to like get teamed up with Batman. That would have been the coolest comic book in the world, and they still could do it. They still could. I mean, in fact, you know, you've got Joe Staton drawing the Dick Tracy strip. Joe Staton did tons of DC comics. So I would love it if they would do that. That would be so good. Like the Joker and Flat Top versus Dick Tracy and Batman. Oh, man. Do it as a treasure. Frank, Diablo Frank, from the World Spy Network says, I count Dick Tracy as another one of those amniotic heroes that I was introduced to in a fetal state pre-memory. If I had to deduce sources, I'd point out that his cartoons ran in early morning syndication, probably the Archie's TV funny segments, but possibly and or the Dick Tracy show. His strip was in one of the Houston papers, plus I recall the house ad for this treasury. I also accessed one of the comic book history books, probably Jules Pfeiffer's, that went on at length about Chester Gould's influence on the comics medium in general and Batman in particular. I recall Flat Top getting a lot of attention as one of the most highly regarded Tracy foes in one of the most popular and oft-revisited cases, plus he was on the cartoon. Much was also made of the violence in the strip and the brutal demises. I've tried to get into the character a few times, but most like pulp and newspaper strip characters, I respect the role they played in shaping what became comic books more than I actually enjoy reading the inspirational material. Yeah, I hear you there, Frank. I'm kind of that way with a lot of the pulp characters, I will admit. I've tried to read some pulps here and there, and I've just never been able to get too far into it. And Frank does have a couple comments on the movie. He mentions the adaptation by Kyle Baker, which was really very interesting, pretty cool. He says Glenn Headley was an asset in the movie's favor. I agree. Rest in peace, Glenn Headley. Great actress. Warren Beatty, not so much. Madonna takes all the heat, but I found Beatty to be bigger blank in every scene. Well done, Frank. Michael Lane from the Comics in the Golden Age podcast says, I came on here to say what a great episode this was and how interesting it was to hear Zoom's background, but after reading the comments, I just feel like Chuck Coletta should start a Dick Tracy podcast. And then Chuck Coletta comes back again, and he says, I think we finally found a topic too obscure for Fire and Water. Absolutely not true, Chuck. If I had managed to find a way to add an eighth or ninth day to the week, I would love to do a Dick Tracy podcast. I think that would be a lot of fun. We could talk about the character and all the different aspects of pop culture or just the strips or whatever. I would dig that. That is not too obscure for Film and Water, especially with some of the episodes I have coming up for some one-off FW Presents. So maybe someday we'll do a Dick Tracy podcast. And if we ever do it, you'll have to come on and be my co-host. Speaking of the strips, Chris Carnes comes on and says, great show covering one of my favorite Treasury editions. My first encounter with Dick Tracy was either in the local Sunday comics, Archie's TV Funnies, where my parents were able to identify the villains before I could, or a TV commercial for Silly Putty. I think the putty was applied to Tracy's Sunday page, or a similar looking character, and then his face was stretched on the image on the putty. I started clipping and collecting the strips, starting with the Big Boy story in June 1978, but only kept up with it for three story arcs. I was later fortunate to have met and spent time with later Dick Tracy artist Dick Locher, who recently passed away, a few occasions. His favorite villain was Pruneface. What is still a mystery to me about this treasury is how it wound up in Joe Strummer's hands while he was poolside in the Clash video Rock the Casbah. Chris, thank you so much for mentioning that. I wanted to mention that in the episode, and I completely blanked on it. I had it in my notes, too, and I just forgot about it. Yeah, I remember being a kid when MTV was just starting and watching the Clash's Rock the Casbah video, which was one of like the early videos that they played in concert rotation. And there it is. There's Joe Strummer reading the Dick Tracy Treasury, which at that point was like a 6 or 7 year old comic book. So I'm completely bewildered at why that's in there, but I loved it. I you know, as I mentioned on the show, I loved the Dick Tracy Treasury, and there it was on TV being read by a rock star, which just gave it such a level of coolness that I never would have aspired to. So yeah, that is amazing. I don't know how that's such a great little detail. Thank you so much for mentioning it. And also, I do need to thank Chris for a very wonderful act of generosity. He sent me two Dick Tracy book collections in the mail. Apparently, he found them in a relative's house, and no one wanted them, and so he wondered if I want them, and I did, and he sent them to me. And that's really very generous. I love them. They're sitting by my book next to my bed with all my other books that I'm working my way through. So thank you so much for that, Chris. I really appreciate it. It was very, very generous of you. I love those old Dick Tracy collections, those little trade paperbacks they used to do. So thanks so much, Chris. Continuing on, Ted Kilvington says, my first exposure to Dick Tracy were the cartoons, which were kiddie fare. That was fine for me at the time because I was a kiddie, but I never felt compelled to actually read the strip. I bought this comic on eBay last year for cover price. Nice job, Ted. As part of a package deal and never read it. After listening to this episode, I trudged down to the basement and brought it upstairs. And much to my surprise, it was adult, gritty, and well done. Surprising because I was comparing it to the cartoons. Thanks for inspiring me to read this. Well, thank you, Ted. I'm glad that you picked it up. $1, man, that's a deal. And I'm glad you enjoyed it. Jerry Hammonds writes in to say, I wanted to say thanks for another great podcast. Really liked it. I had my 73-year-old father listen to it. He was the reason I got into comics. He is a huge Dick Tracy fan and has all the original comics, plus the Blackthorne reprints. Wow, remember Blackthorne? He also has quite a few books on Chester Gould. He was telling me after we listened to the podcast that the reason why Chester came up with Flat Top as a character was that the aircraft carriers during World War II were called Flat Tops, and Chester Gould thought it would be a great character name. That's awesome. I love that. I had never read that. I am sure that I will repeat what others have said, but the violence in the strips were to prove that crime doesn't pay, and if you do these things, you will eventually find yourself in these situations. My father bought this treasury new back in the 70s, and with all his other Dick Tracy collection, I couldn't touch it. Well, now I can, and I have my own copies of many Dick Tracy books as I am collecting the IDW volumes. I also wanted to say that I know the treasuries aren't worth as much as the original comics, but they bring back many good memories for me. I lived in a small Midwestern town, and comics weren't easy to come by, but Walmart and some other stores would have magazine racks, and you could get treasuries. I have a friend from high school, and we talk about how much fun we had with ours. My first one was the Star Wars movie adaptation, and it was the number 2 edition. I had looked at that and read that copy so many times when I was a kid. I still have it today. It isn't in very good condition, but it is all there, and I love it. Thanks for bringing back good memories of when I was much younger. I would love to see Fire and Water do a Dick Tracy podcast. So there you go. Another vote for the Dick Tracy podcast someday. Maybe if you guys want to, like, send me money so I can quit my job, then I could just do podcasts all day, every day, 24/7. Be happy to do Dick Tracy podcast. But, Jerry, thank you for the comment. Thanks for the reminiscences. That's some cool stuff. I didn't know that about the Flat Top. That's a fun little factoid. Now we're going to move on to Twitter, where I have to thank everybody for these retweets and likes. Ace DeBelli, Lacey Field 9, Rolled Spine, Trick or Talk, Toku Deka, Barry Reese Pulp, Eloy Natacha, Joanne Safar, Krypton's Wizard, BTB Blog, Ted Kilvington, Static Healing, Zum Yukinori, Ryan Daly 01, Siskoid, Kyle Benningart, Coffee Comics Blog, M.W. Cronenberg, Comic Reflection, Mike Meltzer, Comics in the Golden Age, BTO and Bat Books, Jordi Buenda, Bill Busha, John D. Knoll, J3KC, Fanholes Podcast, HOCOF, that's History of Comics on Film, Billy D. Delicious, Romaine OTT AVJ, OEUFQUIDANSE, you try to pronounce that, Frederick Emanuel, Tsujo, Motucast, AdRock 512, Krypton Kylie, Cherry Flavored, Lawrence Ginkis Art, HRC 1968, Monkey Butt Chew, great name, Vintage Toyad, John Melky, Romans 8, Eddie Muller, thanks Eddie, The Letter Hack, M.W. Cronenberg, Vander M. Costa, Cinecrisis, Ghetto Angeles, and Legendre Ideal. So thank you, everybody. You know, it's funny. One more thing before I sign off. Great story I read from Mark Evanier, the great writer Mark Evanier, over on his blog, newsfromme.com. And he talks about one time that he was at the Playboy Mansion. And and he talked with Hugh Hefner. And he mentioned, I forget how it came up, but it was something about somebody asked Hugh about a recent issue of Playboy that had sold really well. And they asked him, you know, how did you know that one was going to sell very well? Or did you know that one was going to sell very well? And this was many years into the reign of Playboy. And Hefner said, I have no idea what sells. We really have no idea what we put on the cover. Some issues I thought would do really well bombed, and other ones I didn't think would do well at all did really well. So I really have no idea. And Evanier was very complimentary towards Hefner for having the confidence to sort of be able to admit that. This was a guy that was in the magazine business. He was a titan of the industry, and even he could admit, I have no idea what I'm doing. Stuff just happens. And I think about that when I think about this episode, because I thought the Dick Tracy episode was going to be look, Treasury Cast, even among the network, is a minutia show. It's definitely one of the less popular shows on the network, which is fine. I do it because I love it. It's not because I do it because I think tons of people really want to hear it necessarily. But I thought even within the limited audience of Treasury Cast, I thought the Dick Tracy one would not be a particularly popular episode. But it was, and in fact was one of the most popular episodes, and it got some of the most feedback of any of the episodes, and it got some of the most attention on Twitter. So you never know. I'm glad that we did it. I had a ton of fun with Zoom talking about it, but it just goes to show, you know, there are episodes that I thought would be much bigger than they were, and then the Dick Tracy one I thought, well, even among Treasury Cast episodes, I'm really doing this one just for me and Zoom to have fun. But this one was super popular. We got a lot of great comments. So thanks, everybody. Thanks for the iTunes reviews. Thanks for the feedback on Twitter. Thanks for the comments over on fireandwaterpodcast.com. It's really great. I love reading all the feedback when it comes in. So I guess that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks so much to Chris Franklin for coming on to talk about the Superman the Movie Treasury, and of course being my co-host over on Superman Movie Minute, which debuts on Monday, September 25th. So everybody, please come back. You're already here on fireandwaterpodcast.com. Come back to fireandwaterpodcast.com on Monday, September 25th. Listen to the first of many weekly episodes of Superman Movie Minute. And until then, we will see you later. And until the next episode of Treasury Cast, go big or go home.
Once upon a time, the art of the movies was to suspend belief. Today, the art is to create belief. One of the greatest challenges in the modern cinema was to make you believe that a man could fly. They succeeded in a film called Superman.